Hello, I'm Andrew Lord. This is number 0436, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it's coming to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0436. And this is a very special edition of the Stuff File program. Yes, I know, last week we had a special show too, with a rebroadcast of the annual Meshach and Malik Christmas special, but this show is also rather unique. This is a best-of show that looks back at some of the great guests we've been lucky enough to get this past year. There won't be any Stuff File news in this particular edition. It's just going to be snippets of past conversations. We'll also revisit our favorite idiot of the day at the end of the program as well. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0436, was Andrew Lord, who is a copywriter at Sid Lee. He was also one of the many excellent producers I had back in the day on my old radio show. Thank you very much, Andrew, for doing the guest late on this edition of the program, and we'll get right to the meat of the show as we look back at some of the interviews done over the past year on the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, we started off 2017 by talking to two entertainment icons. Loretta Swit, best known as Hot Lips Houlihan from the hit TV series MASH, and also legendary impersonator Rich Little. Both were on show number 0385. We start off with TV icon Loretta Swit. As mentioned, she is best known for her Emmy-winning TV role on the long-running hit CBS series MASH, but her talents go beyond acting. She is also an artist and an animal activist. She combined those two traits for a book entitled Sweetheart, The Watercolor Artistry and Animal Activism of Loretta Swit. Loretta won her first art competition back when she was only 6 years old. So she's been at this for a while. She knew from an early age that she would be involved in the arts, but not necessarily as a painter.
It took me a long time to appreciate what God gave me, actually. I've never studied. I had a dear friend who studied for years, and we were going to have dinner one night, and she was running late. So I said, okay, you know, I'll wait for you. And she handed me one of her big sketch pads, and she said, here, amuse yourself. I'll be as fast as I can. So I did a sketch, and she came out. She had no idea that I had been doing this since I was a kid, and she just went crazy. She said, how cool, ha, you know. She said, I've been studying for years to learn what you just sort of doodled. I mean, how, why, you know. So I told her about, you know, that I'd been doing that. Anyway, she kept it, she framed it, and for Christmas, she bought me a beautiful artist's easel to encourage me to keep it up, you know, keep doing it. The book, even today, was not my idea. My publisher was on a private plane with me and actually the sponsor, and he saw some of my artwork on my computer, and he said, whoa, wait, hold it, you know. This has got to be in a book. Nobody knows you do this. This is important. And, of course, with my activism, to combine that with a book where the proceeds for the sales will go into helping animals, and it's like coming full circle.
Wow.
I always focused on animal art because I was appealing to that audience, people who would buy paintings or a Giclée prints of animals because they had animals or they loved animals and they wanted to help in some fashion. And then I started taking commissions to do, oh, will you do my little doggy? Or in some cases, the dog has passed on and they want a memento, a memorial. So it just evolved. It just kept evolving.
Animal activism is very important to you. At what point did you realize or that because of your popularity, because of your status as a well-known actress, that you could affect change in the way animals were treated?
I think I've always known that the important thing about fame is that you have a platform. People listen to you, and if you have a cause, you have access to people. They respect you. They listen to you. They know that you're not lying to them, and they believe you. And, you know, I never trashed my belief. I didn't sell some diet cookie that was going to lose 10 pounds in 4 minutes. Or, you know, I kept true to my audience and to my characters. I think I chose my roles carefully. I played strong women, empowered women, and women who were ready to grab their lives and do something essential for the goodness of man with their lives. And, So I knew very early on that television is a very, very powerful teacher. And it was important that my message was one I'd be proud of for the rest of my life.
You're telling a story with your book. We should mention the book is Sweetheart, The Watercolor Artistry and Animal Activism of Loretta Swit. It contains 65 full-color paintings and drawings, and proceeds from the book will be donated to charities and programs that are dedicated to animals, correct?
That's correct. We have formed the Sweetheart Animal Alliance, and the proceeds go into this fund and are channeled out to all those needy groups. This is all going to be going towards helping animals and ending cruelty, putting people out there, educating young people about spaying and neutering, closing down puppy mills, kitten mills, all the horrors, everything that goes on today that is cruel for animals. All the money is going to go towards putting an end to that.
Actress Loretta Swit. Again, her book is Sweetheart, The Watercolor Artistry and Animal Activism of Loretta Swit. That was originally from show number 0385. You can go to the Stuff File website to hear the full interview. Also on that same show was Master Mimic Rich Little. He has more than 200 voices in his repertoire, and he's still as busy as ever. When we caught up to him, he was just getting ready to go onto a Las Vegas stage to perform his latest project, Little by Little, a self-written humorous show about his life featuring over 30 characters. A book with the same title came out at the end of the summer in 2016. There's always something I've wanted to ask you, especially since, you know, you are a master impressionist. At the time that you came along, there were other impressionists as well who were also big stars, and you don't see so many of them today. And I'm wondering, is part of the reason the fact that you guys all did voices of people who themselves were bigger than life, and we just don't have those kind of stars anymore?
That's exactly right. You hit it right on, yeah. We don't. When I came along, comedy was booming, movies were great, a lot of big stars that were fairly easy to impersonate, and today it's a lot tougher.
As an impressionist, were you someone who impersonated either teachers at school or people in your family? Where did it begin for you?
Yeah, it began at school. I imitated my teachers, and I knew this was going to be my lifetime work, because it wasn't long before the teachers were charging a 2-drink minimum and a cover charge. I should have got their signatures down. It would have done me a lot better. But I did their voices. I used to answer them in class on the teacher's voice.
Wow.
Usually the wrong answer. That's what infuriated them.
Clearly the audiences love what you do, but what was it like doing an impression for someone whom you idolized in front of them? What was that like?
Well, it wow, it you know, it took a lot of settling down of my nerves, you know, because I was working with these giants and I was in my 20s and you know, I'm doing the Dean Martin roast standing in front of George Burns and Jack Benny and Bob Hope and all these great comedians. And, you know, it's a lot of pressure, but it was terrific, you know, and they seemed to love it. You know, I did 24 Dean Martin roasts, I think, more than anybody, because if I could imitate more than five people on the dais, they usually put me on the show, you know.
As I mentioned, you've also done the voices of many U.S. presidents, Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, the list goes on. Have you done impressions of the presidents in front of presidents?
Oh, sure. Sure. I once did Nixon years ago in front of him. And while I was doing it, he looked puzzled and he turned to his wife, Pat, and said, Why is this young man speaking in a strange voice? He didn't know I was doing him. But Reagan loved it. I mean, Reagan was my best audience. He had a terrific sense of humor. And I saw a lot of Reagan when he was president. I performed at the White House a number of times. And we became actually pretty good friends. And used to talk a lot, you know, and he had a great sense of humor. Wow, he was, I think if he hadn't become president, he might have become a comedian, because he just loved jokes, and he loved my impression. And, you know, he one time said to me, he said, "Rich, you know, I think you do me better than I do. So when I pass away, I think they should bury you." Luckily that didn't happen,
right.
But I thought of it when he did finally pass. I thought of that remark, you know. We had many great times at the White House. He was the best, just the best.
I find that some people go for, shall we say, heightening the obvious in somebody's mannerisms and voice, but when you do an impression, it's the material that's funny, but the voice and the mannerisms are spot on. You don't really overdo it to try not to be
off. I wanted to be an impersonator.
Right.
And I think an impressionist is one that gives their impression of a famous person. It can be an exaggeration. It can be a cartoon. But I always wanted to do an exact copy. So that's an impersonation. And you know, I didn't really exaggerate the person too much, and that's why I did a lot of dubbing for movies when movie stars had either passed away or lost their voices, because I could do it pretty spot on, and you know, it wasn't a caricature. So you know, that was what I did. I became an impersonator rather than an impressionist.
And then
mimic is the same word, really. It's pretty much the same, but I'm an impersonator, really.
We should mention, you know, I brought that up because you did voices. For instance, David Niven, when his vocal cords were gone due to illness, you did the voiceover, the looping for Curse of the Pink Panther. You also did Peter Sellers' voice for him, and I also understand you did Gene Kelly's voice for him as well, too.
That's right. I did a Christmas special, and I did the voice of Gene Kelly, who had that kind of a high voice when he talked, and I did all the narration.
And it was interesting because they didn't say so, and many people thought it really was him. So I it was part of the agreement that if I did it, I wouldn't tell anybody. And I got away with it. And I guess I got away with it in the Pink Panther movies, too, with David Niven and Peter Sellers. And I did Tony Curtis once for a movie he walked off on. So, you know, I've done a lot of that over the years.
That was Master Mimic Rich Little from show number 0385. What would the Stuff File program be without some guest whom you might consider to be on the quirky side? As usual, we had a fair number of those. For instance, for almost two decades, Ian Feagan has run a very comprehensive website that is entirely devoted to shoelaces. Naturally, we needed to talk to him, so we tracked him down in his native Australia for show number 0386 to find out how he became the world's foremost authority on shoelaces.
Yeah, it's a strange thing to aspire to, and it's certainly not something I aspired to. It simply happened because I put my Ian knot, the world's fastest shoelace knot, onto what was originally just a simple little private website that I used to experiment with. Because it sort of went viral, as we would use the terminology nowadays, back then, you know, when someone put something interesting on the internet, I started getting emails from all over the world and asking me all sorts of questions in relation to shoelaces. And I realized that there was a real lack of knowledge there. Rather than answering the same questions over and over, I started putting the answers to it on my website, and yeah, the site just sort of grew as a result.
Okay, well, let's back up a bit. First of all, describe for the audience what the Ian knot is.
Well, the Ian knot was my original attempt to make a normal shoelace knot symmetrical. So I figured because it ends up symmetrical, it must be able to be formed symmetrically. So I fiddled around a bit by tying a normal knot and then carefully untying it and seeing how it went together. And in doing so, I realized, hey, look, if you form two loops and sort of push them through each other, it creates the identical knot. And hey, guess what? It's actually faster. And within a very short time, I found that I could do it in a split second instead of, you know, 1 or 2 seconds. And so the Ian knot was born.
Okay, you know, I have been accused all through my life of being somewhat anal retentive, and I embrace that. But when I hear somebody say, I need to make a shoelace more symmetrical, wow, that is going to some depth, isn't it?
Well, there was actually a practical reason for it, because I found that this actually happened one morning after I broke a shoelace. And, you know, from tying a shoelace over and over, over its lifetime, it gradually wears out. And I found that one end always wore out more than the other end. And the practical person in me figured, well, look, if I could make this shoelace knot more symmetrical, then I would spread the wear more evenly. And in fact, that's what's happened. Besides the fact that it's symmetrical and it has less wear and tear, the fact that you are actually doing much less work to tie the shoelace, I mean, it's literally a zoop, zoop, and it's done. There's much less wear and tear on the shoelace, and I haven't had a shoelace breakage for, you know, 30-odd years.
You know, it's amazing how much sense that last statement really says. I mean, the idea of the wear and tear on shoelaces, and by the way, shoelaces, I've been my experience, shoelaces always break at the most inopportune times. It's always when you have to go somewhere fancy that your shoelace breaks.
Exactly. I mean, they won't really break when you're untying them. They'll break when you're tying them, and that's usually one of the last things you're doing before you're heading out a door somewhere, and well, there you go.
Ian Feagan, the man behind Ian's Shoelace site. It's the number one shoelace site in the entire world. He was on show number 0386. Not to be outdone is Nancy Three Hoffman from Peaks Island in Maine. We had her on show number 0403. She runs a museum dedicated to umbrella covers. Just the covers, not the umbrellas, just the covers. How did this start?
It was from my own imagination, and I want people to be sure to understand that it's just the sleeves, just the pockets or cases of umbrellas, not the umbrellas or the big tops of umbrellas, just those little pockets that most people lose, forget about, or throw away. And when I realized I had a few collected in my house one day, I started asking other people if they didn't know what to do with their umbrella covers, basically, and they would say, oh, yeah, I have a few here in my house. Do you want them? And I inadvertently kind of collected them until I realized I had something. And the something I have is really the stories behind the covers. So I asked people to tell me, what happened to the umbrella? Where were you when you bought this? You know, give me some anecdote or some little history behind the cover. So they all have their own stories as well.
Wow. Now, how many, you started this, I believe, around 1996, right?
Right.
How many umbrella covers did you initially start off with, and how many do you have now?
Well, the first person I asked gave me two. So I added that to my own five. But, you know, I fairly quickly accumulated a lot. I mean, I had 35 or 40 when my first radio interview happened, and I thought that was a lot. Now I have 1,500 plus. And glad to say I do hold the world record, the Guinness World Record, for the most umbrella covers, which was 730 at the time we did the official count. Wow. So if anyone thinks of challenging me, I'm pretty well covered for any challenges.
Now, I'm assuming that with social media and news coverage, that one thing led to another and people are sending you umbrella covers. Would that be a correct assessment?
That is true. I got three this week, actually, in the mail. And I really, if people want to send me their umbrella covers, I would really ask them to write up a story to say, we found this in my Aunt Millie's closet, or, you know, just something about themselves or about the cover, where they got it, if it came from Austria or Canada or whatever. So that's part of the deal. And the mission of the museum, we state, is celebrating the mundane. So you can extrapolate that to other parts of your life and enjoy the little things as these are.
Absolutely. Now, you give tours at the Umbrella Cover Museum. First of all, you're open, I think, as you mentioned, from the beginning of Memorial Day till Labor Day, right? So it's just...
Right.
Yeah. It's coming
if
up
people
to...
People need to check for the hours because it's really a little bit irregular, and we build up to like our full hours in July. So check on my website, umbrellacovermuseum.org, or give me a call or a text if you're thinking of coming to Maine to visit the museum. Yeah.
Now, in addition to the tours, you also, during the walkthrough, if I'm not mistaken, accompany the tours with a live accordion rendition of Let a Smile Be Your Umbrella. Is that correct?
That is our theme song, yes. And how many museums even have a theme song, I ask you. Plus, people will sing along because the words are posted and we have Shaker Exit. Turns into a rather jolly experience going on a tour at the Umbrella Cover Museum. And hopefully by the end, people will have a big smile on their face, even if they come in with some doubts or concerns about the actual museum and its mission.
Nancy Three Hoffman from Peaks Island in Maine, who runs the very unique Umbrella Cover Museum. She was on show number 0403 back in May. There's more Best of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, coming your way in just a moment.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
This is a very special edition of the Stuff File program, looking back at snippets of some of the conversations we've had over the past year. And speaking of conversations, let me take a moment to tell you a little bit about a book that I'm very proud of. It's called Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. And it's written by me and published by Bear Manor Media. It's a compilation of just a few of the myriad of celebrity interviews I've done over the years. People like Oscar-winning stars Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer, Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner, Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar, a host of TV icons like Buddy Ebsen, Bob Denver, Dick Van Patten, Gary Coleman, and the ever-popular Much, Much More, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. So check it out. You'll find it at Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at BearManorMedia.com. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader. You'll find the links at our website at TheStuffFile.com. So buy the book. What are you waiting for? Okay, back to the best of the Stuff File program. Speaking of books, Glenn Frankel is a longtime Washington Post reporter, editor, bureau chief, and a Pulitzer Prize winner. We spoke to him back on show number 0393 about the Hollywood Blacklist when he was promoting his book, High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. When we talk about the Hollywood Blacklist, one name keeps popping up, and that's Dalton Trumbo, and another movie keeps popping up, that is Spartacus. But High Noon has a connection to it as well that we don't hear much about.
Yes, that's right. I mean, Spartacus and Trumbo marked the sort of death of the Blacklist around 1960, but, you know, first off, there was the Red Scare era that really begins in 1947, when Trumbo, among 10 people, are called to appear before the House Un-American Activities Committee about their communist connections. They refuse to cooperate, and they end up going to prison for up to a year for contempt of Congress. So that begins the whole story, if you will, of Hollywood's involvement with the Blacklist. By the time High Noon is shot in 1951, the committee has come back for, I guess you could call it a sequel, right? They had such a good time, you know, having movie stars and screenwriters testify, they decided to come back again. And that's the point where a screenwriter named Carl Foreman, who's in the middle of writing the script for High Noon, that's the point where he gets called to testify. He, like Trumbo, had been in the Communist Party. Unlike Trumbo, he'd left the Communist Party, but nonetheless, he was going to be a pretty prominent screenwriter, and they want him on the stand. And, you know, the problem is you can't just go on the stand and confess your own former connections to the party and say you're sorry. In order to prove your redemption, if you will, you've got to name the names of people who were in the party with you. You've got to accuse other people of being communists and subversives. And if you don't do that, you're going to lose your job. And that's the dilemma Carl Foreman faces as he's putting the finishing touches on the High Noon screenplay and trying to decide what he's going to do with this terrible, terrible choice.
Now, what about some of the backroom politics involved in this? I know during the Blacklist period, there were some stars who were on both sides of the issues, either defending those who were the writers who were blacklisted or railing out against them. For instance, where did Gary Cooper fall in all of this? He's the star of High Noon.
He is the star. He's an interesting case. He's a conservative Republican from Montana. Comes to Hollywood and becomes a big star very quickly. He's a strong anti-communist. He's one of the sort of founding members of this group called the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals. So his politics are very to the right. But he gets involved with High Noon, and, you know, in 51. He's 50 years old. The studio system, of which he was a great product and a great elite member of, it's beginning to crumble a little bit. And Cooper's not getting the great screenplays and the great roles he used to get. His health's at an issue. You know, he's got family problems. When he sees the screenplay for High Noon, he gets very excited because it's really good. And he wants to do it, and he even is willing to take less than half his usual big star salary to do it. So he gets involved, and then he gets to know Carl Foreman, because Carl's not only the writer of the script, but he's also the associate producer on this for a very smart little independent production company that's doing it. And they get to know each other, and he gets to like him. So when Carl gets the subpoena, one of the first things he does is he tells Cooper about it, and he explains to him how he used to be in the Communist Party, but he isn't anymore, but he doesn't know what to do, and he even gives Cooper an out to sort of, you know, walk away from the movie. But Cooper doesn't do that. Cooper's not only a conservative Republican, but he's also a very intuitive guy. He liked Carl. He trusted Carl. They were working closely together, and he believed him, and he tried to support him, to the point where when Carl does refuse to cooperate, and he is blacklisted, which means he loses his job, Cooper even agrees that he'll support a new little film company that Carl's going to set up. It doesn't happen in the end. The Blacklist is just too strong, and so it fails, and Cooper backs away. Nonetheless, he tried hard, and it's interesting to see how this personal relationship and trust, you know, overcome, you know, ideological differences.
Glenn Frankel, author of High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. Just a bit of the conversation from show number 0393. Now, last summer featured a major anniversary in cinematic history. It was 35 years ago, in the summer of 1982, that we first enjoyed the wonderment that was Steven Spielberg's E.T. the Extraterrestrial. One of the stars of the film was Dee Wallace, who played Elliot's mom in that classic feature. Dee has always been one of my favorite guests, and I will use any excuse to talk to her, as I did back on show number 0409. She knew E.T. was going to be something special.
Oh, I knew that when I read the script. I knew the script was incredibly special, and I remember exactly calling my agents and saying, look, I don't know how much this is going to do for me personally, but I think it's going to do a lot for the world, and I definitely want to be a part of this film.
One of the mysteries, of course, with that film when it first came out is no one really knew what E.T. looked like until you actually saw him in the film. But you were working on the movie itself, so when you saw E.T. for the first time, what did you think?
I loved him. He had a gentleness to me in his eyes, and to work with him was really like working with another actor. They kept him alive all the time for all of us. Yeah, I don't know. It was kind of a weird experience because I had worked with a lot of special effects, but you couldn't really call E.T. a special effect. He was kind of like a castmate in a very strange way. So I really took to him right away, as I think the kids did.
It's one thing to know that the film is going to be special after you read the script, and, you know, there are blockbusters, and then there are blockbusters. We're talking about a movie which back in 1982 was made for $10.5 million and went on to earn $359 million domestically, $619 million worldwide, and was the biggest money-making film for a decade before Steven Spielberg's own Jurassic Park eclipsed that in 1993. What was it like holding on to the tail of that comet as it was taking off?
Well, it was obviously wonderful. I mean, it's what every actor kind of prays for, you know, is to be involved in not only a blockbuster movie, but a blockbuster movie that changes the world that they can be really proud of. And I was, on all accounts. E.T. was, I mean, people are still coming up to me telling me stories of how that movie has changed their life. And I think it's just a movie that transcends that veil of something like The Wizard of Oz and Peter Pan, and it tells us the truth, and it makes our heart remember the truth, and it lifts us up. And I think it will be here for a long, 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 long time.
You know, it's interesting you bring up movies like Wizard of Oz and the like, because, of course, that was an earlier time in film, and no one really knew how long-lasting film was going to be at that time. But now that we have foresight, because of films like It's a Wonderful Life and movies like The Wizard of Oz, we now know that film will be around forever. So what does it feel like to know that long after we're all gone, there will be people watching you in E.T.?
I love it. Who doesn't want to live forever? Come on. And I love the fact that my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren and their children at some point in their lives are going to sit down and go, you see that lady? That's your great-great-great-great-grandma there. I love that. That really touches my heart because I'm a big family girl, you know. So, I mean, I think it's great that millions and millions of people will see me like forever, but it really means more to me to think that people in my own family that I will never meet can come together and celebrate me and remember me and celebrate the movie and kind of bring the family together through that. I love that.
Actress Dee Wallace, one of the stars of E.T. the Extraterrestrial, from show number 0409. That movie role was one that helped to define her career. Well, we go from career breaks to changing careers. In show number 0417, we talked to a former television anchor who quit his job in front of the camera to become a Lyft driver. Anthony Ponce got behind the wheel and also created a podcast. The show is called Backseat Rider, where he basically interviews his passengers, finding out about their story and the details of their interesting lives.
For me, it was a combination of disillusionment with being part of the mainstream media and also a desire to do something that connected me more with my fellow human beings. And I felt like something was missing on the news desk, where I was reading a teleprompter and felt like I was telling the same stories over and over and over again. You know, Chicago weather, Chicago traffic, a shooting, a fire. You know, and all those stories are very important to cover. It's vital information. But I, after about 10 or 12 years doing it, felt like I needed a change. And what happened was I started to kind of notice that I was always talking to my Lyft driver or Uber driver when I would take it, you know, myself as a passenger. And when I'd be driving home from my cush, or I guess I wouldn't say cush, but a dream job, as you put it, gig at NBC, I'd look over and I'd see a Lyft driver or an Uber driver having what looked like a good conversation with their passenger. So I'm like, well, I'm not the only one doing this. Maybe that great conversation is a resource that I could kind of cultivate and harvest off Chicago roadways. And so it was one of those things that was a pipe dream for a while. It was kind of a fantasy I'd talk about it with my wife. And finally, I just decided to pull the trigger last July, and I've been doing the podcast ever since.
I've listened to your show, and it is fascinating. It is well done, first of all. I mean, again,
that's your
background, obviously playing to the forefront there. And for those who haven't heard the show, you ask a particular question each show. Is that how it works?
Yeah. I ask a particular question or explore a particular theme each episode, each week. And, you know, I do all my Lyft rides. I probably drive for two days straight. And obviously there's cultivation involved. I will curate the very best answers, you know what I mean? And I'll really, you know, some people are better storytellers than others. Some people, it takes a lot for me to kind of pull the stories out of them. Other car rides, other Lyft rides are only 5 or 6 minutes long. There's only so much content we can get into. But what I'll do is I'll kind of weave a narrative together based on all the stories and responses I get from a wide range of people. I mean, here in Chicago, it's a perfect place to do it because I'll be driving a CEO 1 minute, and then I'll be driving like a factory worker from the west side or a warehouse worker from the west side of Chicago the next. And so there's just this wide range of people. But the cool thing is, and if you listen to an episode, you probably get the sense of it, is that, like, you realize that we are all sharing a human experience that is not that dissimilar from one another. We all have fears. We've all made risks and taken risks in our lives. We've all dealt with embarrassing situations. We've all been nervous. And the way it is here in the States is that never have we been this divided. And never have we felt more kind of separate, I think, with smartphones and this so-called fake news media and just all the Trump supporters versus all the Hillary supporters, the left and right. We're so divided right now. And I really wanted to do something. This is kind of going back to your very first question, what made me do it. I wanted to do something that not only reminded other people, but reminded myself that we are all connected.
Anthony Ponce, who hosts the excellent podcast Backseat Rider. He was on show number 0417. He really was a great guest. We have more of our special edition of the Stuff File program, a best of retrospective look at some of the conversations we had over the year, and that's coming up after this break.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. I'd like to tell you about a canal in my hometown of Cadillac, Michigan, that was once featured on Ripley's Believe It or Not. The canal connects two lakes, and when the temperature falls to freezing, it covers over with ice before the lakes do. However, it thaws out after the lakes finally freeze over, and it stays unfrozen all winter. Snowmobilers on the lake would sometimes get hurt by driving into the open canal. So, to prevent injuries, each winter volunteers built a temporary fence on the ice where the lakes opened to the canal. They did this for many years. Then, something really strange happened, but it wasn't reported on the Ripley TV show. the volunteers stopped building the fence, even though it was still needed for safety. Why? Because they were told they could be sued if it blew away and a snowmobiler got hurt. Let's be fair, this is just one more example of how the constant threat of being sued in America puts public safety at risk. Learn more about how excessive litigation affects all of us by visiting our website at centerforamericatv.org.
From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
Welcome back to a special year-end edition of The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. This is our year-ender, the Best of The Stuff File program, featuring snippets of some of the conversations we had this year. Now, back on show number 0419, voice actor Bob Bergen was a guest. He is a very busy guy and one who is hard to pin down. Bob is a two-time Emmy-nominated actor and top voiceover talent. He is the voice of both Porky Pig and Tweety Bird for Warner Brothers. He's also heard in a host of animated films from Minions to Sing to The Secret Life of Pets, Monsters, Inc., and the list goes on and on and on. The one thing about animation, especially in film form, is that you do the voices and the film comes out sometimes years down the road. Sometimes when the film comes out, do you forget you actually were in that?
Oh, I'll tell you an interesting story. And the answer to your question is yes. I kept getting emails from people congratulating me. They saw my name in the credits for Sing. And I kept, you know, replying, I didn't work on Sing. And, I mean, more and more people, my mom calls me up. She goes, oh, I saw you worked on Sing. No, I didn't. So here's what happened. I got a call to work 2 days on a feature, non-disclosure agreement. They even gave us a fake name. And I worked for 2 days on this film. Now, when you do work on a film, if you're not playing the lead, you just work on the pages that you're in. You don't even see the whole script. So a week later, I get a call from the same casting director who called me for that one to work on Secret Life of Pets. And she informed me that the previous job was also Secret Life of Pets. Cut to a few years later, I hear I'm in Sing. No, it wasn't Secret Life of Pets. It was Sing. And the casting director didn't even know it was Sing because they kept it from her, too. That's how tight these non-disclosure agreements are. So you forget what you did. You forget that you did. And you never or rarely even know what the story is. So it's fresh when I see it because I literally might have recorded it 4 years ago.
You also teach, which is something we talked about. I guess we should go back to the beginning a little bit because I don't want to rehash the whole story, but what I found fascinating when I first talked to you is the fact that you were a 14-year-old kid who basically went through the phone book and found Mel Blanc, talked to him, got on set with it where he was doing some work. And as the saying goes, the rest is history. And your mom went along this on this ride with you, which I thought was really fantastic because she was basically an enabler to you, wasn't she?
Completely. And I think both of my parents were very supportive because they saw how focused and driven I was. It was like there was no doubt I was going to do this. So now I always tell people, you know, follow your dreams. Usually follow your dreams as I want to be an actor. I want to be a singer. I want to be a dancer. To have one character in mind, that's a toughie. You know, if somebody said I really want to be, you know, Mickey Mouse, I'm like, you know, that's going to be hard. But then I have to go, well, I did it. So, you know, I say to everybody, follow your dream. But my parents were extremely, especially my mom, very, very, very supportive.
Now, you were very specific. When you were a child, you wanted to be Porky Pig. Why Porky?
Because I could do him. I got a tape recorder when I was five, and I would record cartoons. And I remember just announcing to my parents, there's one guy doing all these voices, and I couldn't even read the credits. One guy doing all these voices, I can hear a common denominator, and I found a formula to his stutter. So I was able to, I mean, my voice hadn't changed. I didn't really sound like him, but I was able to decipher how he talked. And then I added, you know, the ad-libbing and the humor as you're creating something other than what you're trying to say, which is, you know, as a five-year-old kid, I don't know what's acting, but acting. So the bottom line is I just knew how to do them.
So basically, at an early age, you got the cadence, and your voice came later as you aged.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I thought I sounded like him when I was younger, but not so much.
I hear you. I know exactly what you're talking about. So let's flash forward to as an adult. You've been doing Porky Pig now for, what, 27 years?
Yeah, 27 years, yeah.
How has your voice changed, if at all, as an adult?
Good question. When I first started doing the character, they would play me about a 20-minute reference. And this was, they were trying to be thorough, but it was really kind of backfired. Because in the 20-minute reference, they had a cartoon from the 30s, a cartoon from the 40s, a cartoon from the 50s, a cartoon from the 60s. And I would say, which one do you guys want? Because Mel Blanc kept evolving as the character evolved, as the writing evolved. And so they, to be honest, didn't even understand what I was saying. So I took it upon myself as an actor to decide, okay, I think Mel really nailed Porky 1953 to 1956, which would be the Duck Dodgers, Drip-Along Daffy, Robin Hood Daffy era. So that's what I would strive for when I would do the character. It's interesting, I just came back, well, not just, but a few weeks ago I did San Diego Comic-Con, and this one gal came up to me, and she said, you know, I know you're not the original voice, but I'm 20, 25 years old, as I've been fresh out of college, and she said, as far as I know, you're the only Porky Pig I've ever known. So when I see some of the older stuff, it doesn't quite sit well with me because I know you from the series Duck Dodgers. I know you from the Looney Tunes show, et cetera, or Space Jam. So that was kind of like a revelation. I never really thought of it that way, that we have generations that have only really seen the newer stuff because they stopped airing. They've got them back now, but for a long time, they weren't airing the classic Looney Tunes. So that was just kind of interesting. The difficult part for me, it's not difficult, it's kind of a fun challenge, but, you know, Mel Blanc, when he was doing the Looney Tunes, they didn't have cell phones, they didn't have computers. They were always references to pop culture and, I guess, you know, even technology of the day. So when you put these characters in situations of today and reference pop culture today, you still have to keep the integrity of the character, but you also have to be able to flawlessly and organically incorporate today with yesterday's characters. It's a fun challenge.
That was the amazing voice actor Bob Bergen from show number 0419. Okay, let's talk underwear on this best of edition of the Stuff File program. Back on show number 0426, we caught up with Tommy Lade. He's the co-founder of The Other Danish Guy, a brand of underwear based in Finland. The brand, which is available worldwide, is eco-friendly, created from fabric that is made of discarded fishing nets and other items harvested from the oceans. We needed to know more, so we caught up with him in Finland to ask him how this company got started.
It was all started by accident. A couple of years ago, we were in New York on a business trip, and my ex-colleague was running in bad underwear, resolving this huge chafed ass, so to say, and kind of that problem escalated during this week in New York, and he ended up in a ladies' room in Manhattan to apply creams and lotions on his chafed butt, and that happened in a ladies' room in Manhattan in a luxury restaurant. So obviously he got caught, and then the barmaid just calm down people, because there was a sort of a mayhem after the scene, and then she calmed down and said, yeah, I think the other Danish guy is having some problems. That's what we got our name from, and the idea first. And then it was a joke, obviously, that okay, running in a bad underwear and having problems with his buttocks, but then it started to morph into something more that made me think that how difficult it is to buy decent underwear, or you can buy one, but next time you need one, it's 100% sure that you never find the exactly the same kind of style or same kind of a comfortable underwear anymore. So I wanted to do something that really exists a long time after you purchased the one first pair. So and that it started like by accident, and now we're here.
Well, the part that I find fascinating, and by the way, people can go to the website for your company, which is theotherdanishguy.com, and I believe there's a comedian who actually tells the story on stage of this whole thing, which is rather humorous. But the part I want to get to is, how do you end up making underwear out of discarded fishing nets?
I searched the material, perfect material, which would be incredible smooth and incredible comfortable. I searched that for a long time. It took me 9 months to find a perfect material because I have no my background is in branding, so I didn't have any kind of a natural skills as fashion industry, so I didn't know what to look for. As I found out that the material which feels perfect is polyamide. I was struggling with myself because I hate that kind of a culture, that fast fashion and throwawayism. And when you talk about plastics, when you talk about polyamide, which is plastics, so I felt uncomfortable. And I then started to search material which could be regenerated or recycled material. And if it could be made from like ocean garbage, that would be perfect. And it took me 9 months more to find that. So my background is on seas as well. I'm basically born on seas because my father was a sea captain, and then seas and oceans mean the world to me, really. And it's heartbreaking to see those videos about seals and dolphins and sea turtles struggling on the ghost fishing on the fishing nets left there by ghost fishing. So I wanted to do something to that matter.
Now I understand that there is a lot of, for lack of a better term, trash floating in the ocean. Certainly a lot of plastics and the like. But as I described in the introduction, discarded fishing nets. I'm not familiar with the fishing industry, so I just find it hard to believe that there's that much of it out there, that there's enough to be recycled into clothing. I mean, are there a lot of discarded fishing nets out there?
There's a scientific organization, so healthyseas.org, and according to the Healthy Seas, there are over 640 tons of discarded fishing nets in oceans. So it's a lot of stuff. Of course, we are doing the yarn is created from other industrial waste, plastic, nylon waste, nylon 6 waste as well. But yeah, there are lots of that stuff in oceans.
Tommy Lade, founder of The Other Danish Guy. You can order your pair of eco-friendly underwear by going to their website, theotherdanishguy.com. Or, by the way, you can also find the links from every guest we've had in this special edition on the Stuff File program. Just go to my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0436, and you'll find the links. Okay, I did promise you a favorite idiot of the day to end things off, but first I must tell you, it was a difficult choice. We had some really stellar contenders of this high honor this year. There were several I could have picked, and I kept changing my mind between several before zeroing in on this one, so let's get to it. Time now for our Retro Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
This year's Idiot of the Day grand prize winner for 2017 comes from show number 0408, and even now it's still a head shaker. He was looking for a ride to Hooters, but got a lift to jail instead. A Florida man was charged with misusing the 911 system when he called asking for a ride from sheriff's deputies to a local Hooters. 28-year-old Jonathan Clayton Hinkle allegedly told dispatchers that his elderly grandmother was suffering from a stroke in the Hooters parking lot in Merritt Island, and he needed help getting there to assist her. Hinkle then said he was running to the eatery as fast as he could, but asked if a patrol car could be dispatched to give him a lift. Oh, don't take my word for it. Why don't you just enjoy the 911 audio goodness?
Is it your grandmother that needs assistance?
Yeah, it's my grandmother's car. She's old and she's...
Where is she at?
She's at Hooters.
She's at Hooters?
Yeah.
Okay, and she, what's going on with her?
She's not able to see real well, and she She's got a lot of things going on in her life. I was wondering if I could give you guys money just to get me up there to help her.
Well, what's going on with her?
Not she's old. And she's just old, and I need to be there. I'm running as fast as I can from South Maryland to try to make it to her. If you guys could...
Do you know why she's at Hooters? Do you know why she's there?
Yeah, she went to Hooters because she was going to Longhorns to eat with my family, and her vehicle messed up. And I know this isn't like a serious emergency, but my grandma keeps having heart bypasses, and she's about to have a stroke.
Do you know she's having a stroke right now at all?
No, nothing like that. She just needs my help really bad.
Okay. Did she call you?
Yeah. I'm running as fast as I can. Just call me back if officers can help you, please.
Okay.
Listen, I'm in a hurry. I'm running down Courtney Parkway, heading towards 7 in Sunoco.
Let me make sure this is clear. You need assistance getting over to Hooters so you can go help your grandmother.
Yes.
But at this time, yes, she doesn't need any medical assistance.
No.
Responding deputies gave him a ride, but were unable to locate Hinkle's grandmother after an extensive search for about an hour around the restaurant. 3 hours after the initial 911 call, deputies were able to locate her. She stated in a sworn interview with deputies that she never called Hinkle to say she was in distress or needed medical attention. Hinkle got his ride all right to the Brevard County Jail, where he was charged with misuse of the 911 system, his fourth offense. The sheriff's office is also seeking restitution from Hinkle in the amount of $222 for the manpower expended for his 911 call. Now, why? Oh, why would you concoct such a ridiculous story about an ailing grandmother just so you can get a ride to Hooters? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0436. Our very special Stuff File year-ender program. The best of show. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0436. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Well, you weren't literally with him. Well, maybe you were, but I don't see how. I mean, he does record these in advance, you know, and... Okay, maybe you did listen with him. Who am I to call you a liar? Personally, I've never met the guy, and I'm not in a hurry to either.